place. Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 8. This is the final stream for tonight, and it's one that's been hotly anticipated, not just during this millennial, but previous years as well, because I'm now here with Asha Logos, and he was last on Millennial in 2018, which is obviously 4 years ago now, and that was a great stream. People really enjoyed it, and they've asked me to have him on in previous years since then. But we haven't been able to manage it for various reasons until now. So, Asha Logos, welcome back to Millennial.
Thank you. And I appreciate you having me, and I also really appreciate this tradition. I don't know how you do it. It must be like herding cats. I mean, I'm one of them. I've been pretty difficult the past few years. I think you've extended the offer every year since 2018, and I've just... not made it happen. So you apologize to me. I should apologize to you. But yeah, what you do here is just fantastic. It's a great tradition. It's comfy and it's fruitful. It's very useful and productive, bringing all these people together. For example, I've been introduced to several people I had no idea about. And yeah, it checks a lot of boxes. And I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for saying that. I hope it does have a good effect on the community in terms of bringing people together, the audience, but also in terms of, as you've just said, showing content creators people that they could be in touch with and Absolutely. Maybe collaborate with.
And one more compliment, not to interrupt you there, but you are exquisitely good at this. I really think that out of everyone else that I could think of in the broader community, I'm not sure a single one of them would be better at the totality of this process. And I truly mean that. You're a conversationalist, so these discourses kind of get along. They get along well, but also in a natural and organic feeling way. And you're just very good at what you do. So thank you.
Thank you very much for saying that. The conversations stuff does come quite naturally to me. The other work involved in it is less the graphics, the organizing it.
There has to be so much involved, so many moving parts.
There are. I mean, a lot of it, the organizing, a lot of that is taken care of by software now that I've written over the years. Hmm. It gets more sophisticated each year. So some of it is simplified, but yeah, the herding of cats is is not something that can be simplified. And yeah, I guess this is anything involving people is going to be like this. But
and just that many people. I mean, how many total this year?
60, maybe 61. I'm not sure.
That's incredible. I couldn't and wouldn't do such a thing. So I appreciate it.
Well,
and
thank you.
Many others do. So thank you.
I'm glad to hear that. As I say, it is difficult, but it's possible, and I'm very glad. I'm very glad to be able to do this.
I'm glad you're proving that each year that it is possible, and carrying it off well. Oh, but no more compliments. Let's move on.
that's quite enough. Quite excessive, really.
Yes.
But thank you anyway. So, why don't you introduce yourself to people who might not know of you?
I hesitate to call myself a video creator. That's always felt strange to me. But most people know me from the content I've created on YouTube and Odyssey and other platforms, which is mostly historical in nature, called Subverted History. But there's kind of an eclectic mix. You'll just have to take a look to fully understand. But I say that I'm uncomfortable with the kind of video content creator label, because for me, that's always just been part of the process. In other words, I felt compelled to try to do something net positive to reach a larger goal. And it struck me that this was a very good first step to that process. And I think that when I'm finished, and I mean, I may never be totally finished, who knows, but when I'm done with the arc of historical video creation, it will probably move into other spheres, meaning this general effort to hopefully get us from point A to point Z. But right now I create videos, and most of them are historical in nature.
And would you say that you are a content creator sort of by accident, as in that is
I would say,
but not quite the goal of the process.
Yeah, I think that for us to get anywhere meaningful and to do something meaningful and fruitful, we of course have to know where we come from and where we started. It's the only way you can get your bearings and know where you're going. And looking around at the present state of historical understanding, it's just so incredibly piss poor and corrupted and subverted and in the worst way. So I knew that this was something, and I also kind of have the motto or the guiding principle of first do no harm. And I think a lot of people can indirectly and inadvertently end up doing some harm with the various approaches they take. And this was one that struck me that if I do it well, and if I do it to the best of my ability, it's almost certainly going to be a net positive. So it seemed like a great place to start.
Right. And if content creation is part of the process, but not the goal, then what is the goal of the process?
Well, I would say that it's a goal that kind of all of us share. I mean, we know we're in a terrible spot at present, and it looks grim, and it's an incredibly uphill battle. And to kind of wrest ourselves out of this, we need to do several things. And so that's kind of an explanation. And one of those things, I think, is gaining a firm understanding of who we are, where we come from. And by doing that, like I said, I think it will become clear. I hope it will become clear to many people where we should head, at least some of the broader level decisions we might make or turns on the road we might make. Knowing, firmly understanding the historical context really puts things into perspective in a way that nothing else can. So I'm certainly not saying that I can help us, you know, perfectly gain that solid footing and foundation, but I can at least possibly have some effect. And yeah. And then I think down the line, I think it will probably need to be a lot of real world action of various sorts. And I mentioned, I think on Twitter a short while ago, how I hope to get two videos out before the new year. It looks like I'm going to hit that goal. Many of you may have started doubting me considering it's already the 21st. But the downside to that is that they're not going to be the two videos I planned. They're going to be a two-part series for the French Revolution, the next subverted history video. So it's an upside and a downside. I had hoped to get the French Revolution video out and another video out, but that other video will need to wait till the starting of the new year. And I mention this because that other video will really start to deal in more concrete terms with what I think we need to do in the near future to kind of escape this slowly closing prison that we're facing.
So would you say, I think you probably would, but I'll put it to you, would you say that the white race was something that had, if we speak about it as a totality, just for the sake of convenience, that the white race was something that had a direction and is now at a sort of impasse?
I strongly believe that if you go back far enough, there was a singular conception that you could refer to as, we could use the term white, we could use the term Aryan, used to be the traditional term, several different terms you could use, some of which make people uncomfortable to various degrees, so we steer clear of them. unfortunately. But yes, I do think that at our root, we had a relatively singular culture and a relatively singular outlook and orientation on life, worldview and perspective, in a much more concrete way. I mean, even up until the fall of the monarchies, extending through the Middle Ages and the French Revolution, extending into the Russian Revolution, there was still some of that, I think, left. We've been kind of divested of all of that. Every last vestige has been ripped from us, and we've just been completely deracinated. But when you go back far enough and kind of take the totality of context together, and you begin to develop, you begin to see a relatively singular storyline, I would say. So yes, I think we did have that at one point, and I think it was something incredibly healthy. And yeah, I think I also plan to show that in the future.
Yeah, I think it's important that people remember, because, you know, in this condition that we're in, it is depressing, it is discouraging to look at the condition that we are in now. And I think it's important, therefore, to remember we are talking about a creature that is capable of incredible things.
Incredible things. I mean,
yes, in pretty much every sphere, yes. Whatever. We're not talking about, I mean, we're not talking about a moron. We're not talking about a charity case. We're not talking about a deserving case. Yeah. We're not talking about an invalid. We're talking about an incredible creature that is currently sickly.
And has kind of forgotten his own powers and abilities. Has been stripped of almost all energy and confidence and everything that makes a human being robust and vital and healthy, I would say. And I think we've been consciously stripped of all of this. And it's simultaneously disgusting and infuriating. And it's kind of what set me down this path, because it is possible to lose almost all of that, at least the superficial and the external. There's always, I think, something, and this is the one positive thing, that even if everything went to complete hell and essentially all history and all information were to somehow be completely destroyed, I do think that we can somehow dive deeply within, if this makes any sense, and rest some of that, pull some of that up, and restore some of that. But losing all of our history, all of the history that we know to be true or we suspect to be true, we can't risk that. That's something that is almost impossible to come back from, and it's the most crippling and paralyzing thing you could possibly imagine. So we just can't sit by while something like that occurs, obviously.
And that is happening. I mean, especially since 2020, the destruction of our history has been monumental. Well, literally, it's been hideous to behold.
And it's on every front and throughout every sphere. And it's so efficient and so being so masterfully done that it's almost impossible for anyone, I think any objective and logical and rational person, to look at this and say that it's coincidence, or that it's just perhaps individuals, as maybe Jordan Peterson would say, moving in individual directions. There is some means and methods that we're not privy to. There's some planning, there's some methodology, there's a plot. I mean, it's fairly obvious. So, our very survival at this point, for existential reasons, we need to combat that with every ounce of strength and every bit of ability that we have.
Yeah, definitely. There are people who make a career out of claiming that it's individuals who do this,
yes,
who are set against us.
Or protect their careers, yes.
Yeah. Or have a second career, as in the case of Jordan Peterson, from doing this. And it is sickening, because especially while they are saying that, they'll also say that, well, we are just a bunch of individuals, therefore there is nothing to really protect.
Yeah,
and I find this absolutely disgusting.
It absolutely is. And I think I did a podcast fairly recently, two or three episodes ago, about what I would call positive tribalism. And I would encourage people to listen to it if they're interested in this topic, because we're very, very good. We've been made very, very good at finding all of the negative aspects of tribalism. When the average person thinks of racial tribalism, for example, they think of Nazi jackboots and they think of people dying in camps and et cetera. So we have that firmly in our mind, the negative things that can potentially or are claimed to result from tribalism. But we miss out on so much when we neglect to consider the positive aspects of tribalism. And these are positive aspects that we've enjoyed throughout our entire history. I mean, a nation traditionally was something much more real, something much more genuine and cohesive and singular and healthy, and something that allowed for a people to do great and incredible things as a people. And it adds so much to every aspect of life. When positive tribalism reaches its ideal, in my opinion, it really does enrich everything across the board. So when we look at the negative aspects of tribalism, at the very least, that needs to be balanced out by rediscovering and reconsidering the positive aspects of tribalism. But I would argue that most of the negative aspects have been so hyped, so exaggerated, that if you were to balance the positive against the negative here, the positive would massively outweigh the negative. I mean, there's no reason that when a people suddenly finds itself and finds its identity, that they suddenly need to exterminate all other people. That's absurd. And this is kind of what we've been told, that the moment, especially people of a Western background, the moment they find their identity and their culture and perhaps raise a banner and foster some unity, then all hell will break loose. And that doesn't need to be the case. And in fact, with decent and genuine people, and I truly believe we are that by and large, broadly speaking, it's virtually not a threat at all. I mean, I would even argue that history kind of backs that up, true history, not the history that is currently being shoved down our throats. But I hope that makes some sense.
Yes, indeed. One thing that I would ask you about is the relationship between, you say, tribalism. Some would say nationalism. But then there's also mm-hmm. this idea that the nation state is actually a very modern thing, very recent. And that what we... But here's the thing. It's clear that, for example, English people really cared about England. They... I'm not going to say that they... I think it mattered to them. I think it deeply mattered to them.
Yeah.
And so that's obviously a nation. It's not a region. It's not a tribe. Mm-hmm. It's not their local. It's not their town or their village. It's the whole nation. So what would you say about this tribalism versus the nation versus collective Europe, continent, civilization?
Well, that's an important distinction. I use the word tribalism very purposefully because I think it extends far above and beyond mere nations, but it even extends beyond things like, you know, genetic heritage and race. All of us are tribal. We like to think we're not now because modernity tells us it's a negative. So we like to kind of disabuse ourselves of the notion that we're tribal, but we're immensely tribal. I mean, whether it be our religion, whether it be our immediate family or extended family or our family line, whether it be our race, whether it be our culture, whether it be our language, our nation, all of this could be said to be tribalism and so much more. I mean, even our tastes in music and movies, et cetera, books and literature. So all of this could be considered tribalism to some degree, depending on how broad you want to get with your conception. And I tend to think that, especially now that nations aren't really, they don't fit the traditional definition of nations. They're kind of sick jokes relative to what nations used to be. They feel very artificial. And so that word and that concept means far less. And I've even used the word nationalist to describe myself from time to time in the past, but I've never been fully comfortable with it because that's not kind of where my heart lies. The reason I use the term is because I do think that nationalism is a fantastic counter to globalism, which is obviously a foremost threat at present. I think it's one of the only ways we counter globalism. There needs to be smaller cohesive units. If you think of what globalism is trying to do, they're trying to erase every border, erase essentially every distinction, every culture and race eventually. And anything that can be done to combat this, and I think nationalism is one of these routes, should and could be used. But nationalism, to me, is almost a short-term tactic. I hate to put it that way, but nations, most nations that presently exist, and I include America here, I don't think will last a great deal longer, at least as is. So in that sense, nationalism has become a very strange concept to consider. And this is why I'm more drawn to tribalism and a broader view of tribalism as a definition.
So you would say that the nation is an artificial thing, at least today. People will look for something more specific than the nation.
To an extent, it's always been somewhat artificial in almost every instance, but especially today, it's become extremely artificial and more so by the day. But there have been times in which a nation has been a good archetypal example of a combination of racial, spiritual, many different types of tribalism kind of rolled into one. So the nation has kind of been a proxy for that. In that sense, nationalism and getting behind your nation makes a great deal of sense to me. But other than that, and considering what nations are today, it would be hard for me to just say, yes, I'm a proud nationalist, full stop, without caveats, because it's becoming a less meaningful term. And I think as we enter this period of chaos in the next decade, it will become, I'll say, less meaningful. It could become even more meaningful in some narrow instances. But overall, like I said, nations don't fit the definition of nation in my mind and in many minds anymore. So it's a strange territory.
It is strange territory because you want to advise, you know, as a person who other people listen to, you want to advise and you want to clarify, but it's not clear. That's the trouble. You know, I know that I have a lot of people who listen to me who would describe themselves as nationalists, and I'm not against nationalism, but I am aware of the various factors that are at play now. The fact that nations are too small to be important on the global stage, but also too big to be important psychologically.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's a weird thing.
And there is, I don't want to sell them completely short, there is definitely something meaningful to, and uniquely meaningful, meaning you mentioned England. There's something that England represents when people hear that word and use that word that isn't perfectly represented by its constituent parts in isolation. So it isn't just represented racially or just spiritually or just culturally. It's kind of an amalgamation, conglomeration of all of these things and more. So in a sense, it takes on its own tribalistic identity and persona that's entirely unique to itself. And there's always a chance that that identity can be a profoundly healthy one. So in the cases in which that's happened throughout history, that type of nationalism and resonating with that type of nation could be an extremely fruitful and productive thing. But yes, we're not quite there in 2022.
Yeah. And I also think that one thing is clear, which is you don't need to be exactly sure about whether you want the nation, the region, the tribe. But it is clear that for my own self, I know for a fact that I am against globalism.
Yeah.
I know for a fact that I just oppose it. What they're trying to do is meld everything together and create a sort of generic universal system that will sustain the unidentifiable masses, yeah. The mush of the human species, mm-hmm. in their various needs, nutrition, entertainment, distractions. I mean, this is not a, it's just not a meaningful existence that they're building.
No, not
and
at
that,
all.
That seems to be intrinsic to globalism, to make
Absolutely.
Everything ever bigger, ever more interconnected, ever more generic, and ever more meaningless.
Their desire is to strip the meaning from life. I mean, that you need to make people into cogs that are willing to be cogs in a machine that are kind of atomized and drifting. And anyway, didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Well, that's really the point. I mean, this is just something awful. It's just something hellish. So you don't really need to know what you're for, at least not just now. You can just look at that and think, okay, I am against that. I'm definitely against
exactly. that. And we should be making a lot of alliances accordingly. I mean, there's a very, very big tint of people who kind of fall under that rubric who would agree with us there. And those can be very meaningful alliances that can do serious and significant things. I would love to see us, there's an art to everything, and there's an artful balance that needs to be struck between, what's the best way to put this? Between being too narrow and purist and also being too tolerant and broad in terms of how we deal with other groups and demographics moving forward. And I think that many people in our ranks can be purist to the degree that anything smacking of big tent bothers them a great deal. Like we're speaking about this alliance between people who are just against globalism. It can accomplish incredibly meaningful and fruitful and productive things if it's allowed to do so, if it's allowed to fully manifest to its fullest potential and do so. But that requires us trying to strike the most artful balance possible between bringing people in and keeping people out of the fold, if that makes sense.
Yes.
People and ideas.
Yeah, I agree. This is something that has to be handled delicately. And also you have to look at, well, what is useful rather than what is ideologically sound? Mm-hmm. What will actually help us practically to get to something? Is this person, might not be perfect, might not be what we'd choose, but they're good at what they do, versus this person who is an ideal Aryan Übermensch, except that he's a fucking sociopathic misfit who can't get along with anyone. Yeah. This is a real thing in our circles, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't think we've even begun to fight yet, in the sense that I think that there's so much potential and so much talent that is just fully untapped. And what it's going to require to discover that and kind of tease it out and pull it to the surface is more leadership and more structure and more forethought as to, with this specific goal in mind. I can envision, in fact, the video coming after the new year will deal with a lot of this and give some ideas on these fronts. But I mean, I think you kind of started out the discussion by saying that we do historically have a great deal of potential, to put it mildly, and that potential is lying latent within all of us as we speak. And we've done a terrible job in my opinion, over the past decade or so. I mean, granted, we've been opposed by an unlimited amount of money and controlled opposition type manpower and every kind of uphill battle you could possibly imagine. But
I think this goes back farther than the last 10 years. I mean, I would say,
oh, absolutely, yeah,
what we call nationalism, we'll just use that term for convenience. Nationalism has always, and I don't like to disparage my, you know, people who gave their lives to this cause, who sacrificed everything. Unfortunately, I think they did go about it in, they made mistakes that what I would regard as obvious mistakes. And one of them is that they appealed, they gave up on the idea of appealing to those high up in society. And then, you know, or one, they were cut off from that. And then they just gave up on that and started appealing to those lower down in society, which creates, I'm sorry to say it, I really, I don't regard myself as a particularly elite person. I know exactly
what you're saying. I think.
Middle class and all that. But still, I think this is a problem because you end up with a movement that is very uncouth and unattractive, unappealing.
Completely know what you're saying.
Yeah, and this is something that, you know, in Britain, I think this has been a huge problem because then our enemies can just point at us and say, well, who would want to join this? They look at it, so it's ugly.
And I couldn't resonate with that point any more than I do. But two things in our defense. I think one is there's been what I call institutional capture going on for decades now, and masterfully well, to the extent that virtually all of academia, and that's barely an exaggeration at this point. When I say all, I mean just about all. Academia, media, just about every sphere that has, and of course banking and finance, every sphere that has real power and real influence has been almost entirely captured by one, calling it a political wing would be too superficial. It's deeper than that. One ideology, one ideological wing, and it's certainly not ours. So we've kind of been forcibly kept out to an extent.
Systematically,
absolutely. But also the second point is that they've used that power, especially in the media and entertainment, but also even in academia and other spheres, to make us look just terrible. I mean, just embarrassingly bad. And I don't think some of that is justified because I know some of these people do exist that just probably shouldn't be speaking in front of a microphone or a camera ever or producing any types of content or at least until they've maybe, you know, taken a few years to mature and learn a few things and create a solid foundation under their feet that are just terrible. I hate to use that word optics, but I mean, we all know it's true. They scare people away. And I have a few friends that aren't quite where I am politically. And they're well-to-do, very successful in especially the economic sense. And I've been kind of leading them over in my direction over time. And one of the kind of stumbling blocks is that they'll see someone like a Baked Alaska, for example, or a Beardson. I don't mind dropping those two names.
No.
And they'll run for the hills because they'll say to themselves, okay, not only do they sound kind of ignorant and stupid, but they're just not people that I would ever want to spend a minute with. They make me cringe. They're embarrassing. They're everything about them is kind of radiating an energy that doesn't exactly draw people in, to put it mildly. I'm sure maybe they're having fun in their own little subset, but I think that they're having a net negative effect, broadly speaking. And we need to start considering that deeply. That doesn't mean everything needs to be optical, but it means that we need to keep optics in mind as we do things.
Let me say something about optics. And I've always been a defender of the idea of optics.
And I hate the word. It just means handle yourself decently. Speak well. Carry yourself as you should.
On the one hand, it's a term that should be self-explanatory, but it's not. It's one that annoys people because they think you're caring about how you look.
Yeah.
You're trying to impress your enemies.
It's like selfish posturing to them.
Yeah, exactly. When you know, you must know that your enemies are going to hate you no matter what. Yeah. So why cuck to them? Why try to placate them? But what I would say is optics is not just about how you look or even how you sound. It's about the atmosphere within your circles, within your atmosphere, within your organizations. It's about the tone of things. So therefore, if you maintain a certain tone, there will be a certain attitude that's promulgated.
Exactly.
If you don't, then there'll be a different attitude that's promulgated, and you'll end up frightening away high quality people. I mean, I remember an organization, and it's not one that people will know about, so don't try to guess what I'm referring to here. It's not really important now. It was an organization, and their attitude was, well, the more people, the better. We just want loads of people.
Yeah.
And that organization quickly fell apart and became full of feds and of course, misfits, weirdos. And, you know, I don't like saying that. You know, even as I say those words, I'm feeling, come on, man.
Yeah,
we're all a bit outsiders. Yeah. Do you really want to shit on? But the thing is, unfortunately, there's being an outsider, and there's being an outsider who's just a weirdo.
Yeah.
Who's just a fucking weirdo. I mean,
well, see,
sorry, but it matters.
I think we're both somewhat, maybe empathetic is the word. I have the ability to feel for people. I try to pair that with enough strength to where it doesn't become a drawback, because it's so easy for empathy to become a pronounced drawback.
Yeah.
But you need to strike a balance there. I think we're both somewhat similar in that regard, so I completely get you there. But everybody needs to know that this isn't a game or a social club or a way to, you know, kill time and have a few giggles. Or for some people it is, and that's fine. But when those types of people start to become the face of things, or when they start to, I mean, of course, we have very little control over who or what becomes the face. But to the extent that we do have control, and within the individual organizations and institutions we choose to rally behind and rally around, we need to take great pains, I think, to make sure that they're on the proper frequency, radiating the right energy, if that makes any sense. And
making the right impression, yeah.
Yes. And not just for our enemies, of course, but also for the people who are on the fence. It's incredibly important for those types of people. But as you said, for everybody within the organization, if you look at any organization that's experienced tremendous political or cultural success and attained significance accordingly, they had ritual down to an art. They knew when to be solemn and serious. They knew when it was okay to be otherwise. All of this stuff was consciously and artfully approached, in my opinion. It wasn't just some people, you know, having some giggles and using the N-word and whatnot. That stuff doesn't help us and doesn't get us anywhere.
One other thing I would say about this that might make it more tangible for people. Millennial used to be very, rough and ready. I did it in 2015. It was completely chaotic. Then I did it in 2016, still on Google Hangouts. And, basically in more recent years, I've tried to make it more fancy with proper graphics, now a proper intro and an outro, sounds that people will associate with millennial, or sound effects so that it's all a recognizable brand. The trailer is consistent across the years. There are motifs, visual things. So it becomes a thing. I don't like the term brand, but there's no other word for it. But most of all, I want it to seem polished. Now, we could be doing a live stream just with no avatars even, the generic faces that it would put in there. No overlay graphic, no intro, no music, nothing. But that would not feel the same. Now, you can say, but the content would be the same. The intellectual substance would be there. And yes, it would. But it wouldn't create the same impression. It wouldn't create the same atmosphere.
Exactly. The atmosphere is the key word there. And it's key, and people need to recognize that. And I think you do very well, which is one of the reasons why I gravitate towards, one of the reasons why I'm here, for example. I think you do a very good job, and you understand these things, I think, in a way that a lot of people don't.
I mean,
and we need to.
Yeah,
we all need to.
I'm not saying this to boast or to congratulate myself. I'm trying to communicate to other people, this stuff matters.
Yeah, exactly. Even just caring enough to say that and knowing that it matters, that's a step in itself. Even if we put your proficiency aside, just you just saying and starting out with the fact that you know this matters, you recognize it, and you're going to work at it. I mean, I became a video creator almost overnight, knowing nothing about what I was doing, because I felt so compelled inwardly to do something net positive in this sphere. And I was just, it was kind of a love for my people and for several things, for my culture. And it just propelled me naturally, and it became easy. And it propelled me in such a way that I wanted things to be presentable. I wanted to put a good foot forward. There's so many reasons to do that. There's so many reasons to take pains to do that. If you truly care about what you're doing and care about what you're working toward or fighting for,
definitely
you need to take those pains.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I spent a lot of time this year and last year working on the graphics and so on, because I wanted to look different each year so that it's fresh, so that it's that year. So people will associate, you know, this look with that time and so on. But it's worth it, because, and I think that people appreciate it. I mean, they might not even notice it, but it creates a sense of something. It creates a feeling that is there throughout the whole thing. And, you know, again, I'm not saying this to boast about it. And some people might not even like the aesthetic this year. Fine. What I want you to understand is that, you know, that I do this partly because I want to have a sense of accomplishment myself. I mean, this is really crucial for me. I'm very driven. I need to know that I've done my best.
Yeah.
But also for the practical reason that it will result in something that is of higher quality.
Absolutely.
And I think this is, you know, basically, if something's worth doing, it's probably worth doing well. Now,
yes.
I have affection for stuff that's like the early Hangouts and all that, Google Hangouts, the rough and ready nature of it. I have affection for it. But if I were still doing that and not bothering to make it better, I would feel a bit guilty, to say the least. I mean, I would hate it, actually. I would feel,
Well, see,
one I could have done better.
Yeah. One of the things I think you do a great job at is creating, we use the word comfy and wholesome quite often, especially in the Frog and 4chan circles and whatnot. And it makes perfect sense, because we all naturally gravitate towards what intuitively feels right. And it's these little things that can help create that atmosphere. And nobody's going to want to come to your atmosphere or your environment, or it's almost like you're hosting a home and you get to decorate it in the manner you want. And those things matter. The outward appearance matters. The inside matters. How you greet people at the door matters. All of it matters. And if you pretend that it doesn't, you're going to suffer for it. And everybody's going to have a lesser experience because of that. And I think if we can kind of artfully stoke that comfy and wholesome factor in the things that we do, especially things like this, I mean, this is what makes this tradition so great, in my opinion, is it really has that on a deep level.
So, well, thank you. I guess we were, I mean, there's obviously a lot that we could pick up on from what you've said, but let's get to slightly different. Well, actually, there have been some questions based on what you've just said, so I'll ask those now, because they probably be less relevant later on. Have you heard of the 10 lost tribes theory being the heirs of the Europeans? If so, what was their admixture, or were they settlers? I've never heard of
them. I'm afraid that's too big of a question for this cast, if you don't mind me artfully sidestepping. That will be dealt with in the near future, and there's a lot to it, and it's going to be an absolutely fascinating deep dive, but there's no possible way I could do it justice, even in a half hour, let alone 2-minute comment, if you don't mind.
Okay.
I have my reasons, but they'll make sense over time.
Here's another one. Yes, here's another one. Does Asha Logos feel that the term Aryan should or can be reclaimed?
I do. I started out thinking that perhaps it should be, if not discarded, at least minimized in terms of its usage. But the more time has progressed, the more I've become a very strong proponent of reviving it, because it was used universally before, let's say, approximately World War II. If you look at virtually any scholar talking about human migration and cultures and history in general, that tended to be the kind of umbrella grouping of European peoples for countless authors. I mean, I could think of 10 off the top of my head. So it was the label, and it was solely because of the view we have chosen to embrace, many of us have chosen to embrace, of World War II, that so many people have been frightened away from. I mean, what is, and I think purposefully frightened away. There's so many linguistic tricks that are being played at the moment. And when you control language, you control thinking. And when you can keep people from mentioning certain terms, force them to use other terms, you're changing the way they think. You're changing the way they process reality on the most fundamental levels. So keeping people from using that umbrella term, I think, was a conscious effort, if I'm being honest. And I think the best way to fight against that is to reverse that. I do think that it needs to be embraced in the most careful and thoughtful way, because we do need to understand that there are a lot of good and well-meaning people who would have immediate red flags go up in their mind the moment they hear that term and would object for various reasons. Many people think it's just the Iranians that are Aryan. Others say just the Indians that are Aryan. There's several different peoples that make this it's just us argument. So there's lots of different passionate arguments that could be made. But it was the umbrella designation for the longest time. And it's one of the only fitting umbrella designations, in my opinion. Virtually nothing else. White doesn't really appeal to me. It doesn't work in the same way. And it's not as accurate, not as fitting.
There's not much romance about it, is there? Where the word Aryan is immediately redolent.
There is so much, etymologically speaking, to the word Aryan. Yes, it is our term, and it's one that we should learn to re-embrace carefully and artfully, but re-embrace. Yeah. That strongly.
Yeah, I agree with you. Okay, so we were talking earlier about how we are at an impasse. What would you say are the forces involved in that? Would you say that there is civilizational exhaustion? Would you say that atheism is part of it? Obviously, there are foreign influences exacerbating it. I don't think either of us would be in any doubt about that. But what are the forces involved here?
Well, they're all so inexorably intertwined that it would be very difficult to kind of piece them out and isolate them, because they really are just so interrelated. The civilizational exhaustion, I believe you said, would tie into the atheism, which would tie into, I think, virtually all of this is being both consciously and unconsciously pushed by a subset and a culture of men who, I think, now in their heads see the finish line in sight. And that finish line is a globalist world in which they are the ruling administrative class, that it would be a structure and system very much like China, in my opinion, in terms purely structurally. I think that people like Trudeau, for example, people like most of the WEF folks, including Schwab, seem to look at China and get their cues. They seem to be fascinated and kind of in love with China's structure. So that tells you a great deal. And I think that they know, at least those at the very top, and by those at the very top, I'm referring to the men who helped create the philosophical foundation of all of this, and the political and economic as well. But more than anything, the philosophical, and you could even say spiritual in a sense. They understood that you need to fully deracinate people. You need to sap them of every bit of natural strength and robustness. You need to do X, Y, and Z to turn them into essentially domesticated cattle that will think that they're free, but be under the most disgusting type of servitude, and not just servitude. It's not like you're chained to something picking cotton in a field, of course, but it's deeper and worse than that, because our world has become so narrowed by these people. Our understanding of reality, our understanding of the possibilities of reality and existence, all of this has been so narrowed and so constrained to an absurd degree that the average person alive today, and I strongly believe this, and I encourage people to look at videotape, especially with people speaking, even just in the 80s and 70s and 60s, and listen to how much more eloquent and erudite and not just that, but there seems to be more health, more confidence. They seem to care more. So on nearly every level across the board, we've been turned into lesser human beings, I would argue. Less capable, less energetic, less optimistic, certainly less recognizing our potential and possibilities. So we've been neutered in a very real sense and turned into this just, and of course I'm speaking broadly and there are exceptions, but we're all kind of being dragged in this direction. So it affects some people far less than others, but virtually nobody is an island that is completely unaffected. We're all being cheapened and lessened in such a fundamental way. And it's just disgusting to watch. I'm not sure if that answers your question. I've kind of forgotten your question.
I can't actually remember the question either, but this is this is an interesting line that we're on here. People sometimes say the only problem is the foreign tribal influence. And if we get rid of that, everything will be fine. Now, first of all, I don't believe that everything... first of all, I'm not trying to minimize that the problem that they're referring to.
Yeah.
But firstly, I don't think that that would be the end of the matter. I don't think that everything would be fine.
Oh, not overnight. Absolutely not. We've been destroyed. We need to rebuild. Yeah.
But also, I don't believe that we will shake off that foreign influence until we first rebuild ourselves to some degree. And so continually talking about like that, as if that's the solution, that's the only problem, and this is, I'm going to get rid of it. And then, blah, 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 blah. I think that is not correct. I really think that we need to work on ourselves. And I say this on an individual basis to people, but I also think collectively this is true.
Yeah,
because
I think it's both.
We need to build up that inner strength. You know, if you think about a child being bullied at school, he might well hate his bullies, but he would stand a much better chance of fighting back against them if he had strength. Whereas if he doesn't have strength, he can kick and scream and shout and whatever and tell the teacher and ask for help, but that's all he can do. You know, in the end, he's not going to overcome his oppressor.
Yeah. And that's a good example, because if you took the bully away, the kid would still have all of these problems. Meaning the next time a bully comes around, he's going to fall into the same rut and just be thrown for a loop. So he needs to fix the internal. So both are absolutely true. I mean, this force, I believe, has deracinated is a fantastic word, but just truly decimated and destroyed us, spiritually speaking, psychologically speaking, completely stripped of confidence. I mean, the type of confidence that the average person and also the average nation or culture would have in itself many decades ago. It's just a night and day difference between then and now. And the types of people that have the confidence has has almost been inverted. So one of the things that's happened in our just completely sick and degenerate culture is the people who least deserve confidence are now the people who just have gobs of it and yes. are the most confident people in the world. Yes. And so many people that truly, in any other era, they would have been, you know, not only confident, but they would have likely been at the top of whatever hierarchy was around at that time, are now sitting near the bottom of a hierarchy and not knowing what to do with themselves and lost and drained and exhausted. And we've lost, I hate to say it on a near Christmas special, but we've lost many of these people. And it's something I think about often. I knew some of them. Some of them wrote to me, reached out to me. And I know there are far, far more that that never did. And those are people who are no longer with us in large part because of this immense drain. And it's more than a physical drain. It's more than a psychological drain. It's even more than a spiritual drain because it's just all spheres. And it feels like it's intentional and conscious and purposeful.
It is. It is. But I do think that the best thing, you know, the path here is to turn ourselves into people who don't get oppressed, yeah. who can't get oppressed.
I fully agree.
You know, and that's the first thing. And then we actually change the situation.
On that note, one thing I'd like to add is that many in our ranks seem to view this situation as we need to somehow convert the entire nation or the entire world in some kind of democratic sense to accomplish our aims or get where we need to be. I completely disagree, and I think that's so much barking up the wrong tree. There's certain subsets of people that are so far gone, so far indoctrinated down that path, that they're essentially dead to the world and lost in a very real sense. And you're not going to win those people over, certainly not with intellectual arguments. The only way those people will come around to see the light is when they're allowed to fully embrace their philosophy and their ideology and their the manner in which they say they choose to live. Let them do what they want. Let them embrace that to its natural end. And when it all collapses around them, that's the only point at which they may look up and say, okay, we did something wrong here. What can we learn? But we're not going to convert the average, 10 hours a day Netflix watching, left-leaning mainstream media watching individual. It's just not going to happen. And I think people often get so hopeless because they believe that that our only path is to somehow convert, 51% of these people to manifest real change. And that is just absolutely not the case. Not only that, but I would argue I don't want to live next to most of those people. I absolutely don't want to. Certainly not now, maybe even in their ideal form after they've gone through some healthy changes, because so many of them seem just so profoundly unhealthy and so profoundly, their judgment is just piss poor. They have no discernment. There's very few redeeming qualities. So it would be better, in my opinion, and this is why I'm such a strong advocate now, of finding a way to create parallel institutions, parallel societies, even parallel banking, parallel everything over time. It'll be an incremental process, but it is possible. And we don't need to drag the entirety of the national population with us. And it's a pipe dream to pretend we can, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think they'll come around when it's the fashionable thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Most people do. Yeah. Most people are on that setting most of their life. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can give you an anecdote about someone from my past. When I was 18, there was a girl and we were friends. And we sort of lost touch. We drifted apart, as you would expect, as I evolved politically. And And that was, you know, we were friends when in the year 2000, so it was a long time. Then I got doxxed in 20, so we lost touch in 2008. Then I got doxxed in 2017, and she read about it in the newspaper and decided to contact me and get in touch. And so that was that, and she questioned me about my beliefs. She said that she considered herself a feminist, so it's offensive to her that I said that women shouldn't have the vote, all this kind of stuff. Yeah. And then she got in touch again a few years later. And I'm not going to say that she'd converted and she was on our side. Not at all. Yeah. Not at all. But mind you, some people from my past have done that.
Yeah.
You know, I have actually been contacted by people who've said, you know, I've realized that you were right, or I've discovered your what you've done in your adult life. And I just want to say that I agree with you. You know, people that I knew as a child, you know, it's quite strange.
Yeah, I've certainly had that experience.
But with this particular girl, she contacted me again a few years later, like about a year ago. And she wanted to meet up. And it was only a few emails that went between us. But I realized that just in that small amount of text that we have absolutely nothing in common.
Yeah. Like
there is no way for me to interface with her. You know, she mentioned Netflix. It's actually funny that you mentioned that right now, because she mentioned that. She said, I just assume that everyone has Netflix. She said something about that. And I thought, my God.
You know, people.
Nothing. I mean, like, when I think about my life, she would probably think it's incredible. Like, it would never occur to her that you could get banned from PayPal, for example, or that you could be banned from Twitter, or you could be banned from YouTube, or whatever. This life is just utterly unknown to her.
They're so far into their own world.
Absolutely. But moreover, on a deeper level, her philosophy, her worldview is completely mainstream, completely just unthinking. Yeah. She thinks she's thinking. And I looked at her Instagram last year. And, you know, she's a photo of her on the train with the table on a train. And she has a book, Everyday Feminism, or something like that. And she'd captioned this photo, good reading material for the journey, for the train journey. And I thought, oh, my God, this is just a nightmare.
That type of personality will even Google, like, books to read on a train. And then go and get those exact titles. It's incredible how much they follow. Pardon my interruption, but it's terrifying, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
They have to follow a script in every realm of life.
It seems like it. It seems
and
like
what happens when you live your entire life that way, and this is a relatively new thing because technology, I mean, the printing press changed things, but now technology has shoved that information in front of all of us every day of our lives to where people are being shaped in a much more singular way. And like I said, we're being cheapened. We're being turned into lesser beings on the most foundational levels. And to me, that's the greatest sin of all. And these types of people, I'm not sure if she was one of them, but this is one of the reasons why I live in solitude for the most part, is that it's not just depressing to me. It's almost like uncanny valley terrifying to talk to most people and realize that it sounds, I don't know how to put it in it's certainly, I don't mean it in a pretentious way, but it seems like there's nothing there that would intrigue me in any way. There's nothing that I would find interesting or insightful or unique or.
They don't seem to think.
Yes, they've lost the ability to think in the most meaningful definition of that term.
And I can give you a...
It's regurgitation and memorization.
Yeah, I can give you a stone cold example of that from this girl. Because the other thing that I should have mentioned, when she contacted me in 2017, she was quizzing me about why don't you like loads of foreigners coming into the country? You know, and so I explained, you know, and her answer was, well, look, if you want to live in a country full of white people, why don't you just move to Sweden? And she obviously didn't even know. Like, this is what I mean. She didn't even know that Sweden.
Yeah. Well, they know virtually nothing. And I I hate to be that broad, but it's true.
At that time, Sweden was being called the rape capital of Europe.
Yeah.
Because of all the, foreigners. I mean, she didn't know. She knew nothing.
And in their defense,
she thought she was in a position to lecture me.
The only thing that one could say in their defense is that they don't know anything in these spheres because they've been taught that there's nothing to learn, nothing interesting to learn in these spheres. In other words, race and culture are completely unimportant. It doesn't matter one whit what the demographic makeup or that there's, cohesiveness or homogeneity. None of that matters at all. What matters is, GDP. What matters is patriarchy is dissolved, personal freedom, etc. So they're taught that it doesn't matter at all. And thus they have no reason to even dig into these spheres. So they never get a hint of what the problems truly are, which is some strange paradox. And obviously it's purposeful. I think that once again, those at the top knew that they were kind of creating these psychological prisons and these ideological prisons that these people would never stray from. They would become content, like I said, reading from a script or getting their cues from on high, and they would never see the need or feel the desire to stray into independent and critical thinking territory.
Indeed. And I wonder, does she even realize that she's not even thinking? I mean, for example, if Sweden is a white, it's not, but let's assume that Sweden is a white country, and mm-hmm. she's telling me to move there. Well, what about Britain? Was it not a white country?
Yeah.
So why Sweden and not? She isn't even thinking about that. She's not questioning anything that she's saying.
Well, the sad irony there is most people like that tend to think that they're brilliant because they surround themselves with the books that say the right things from the right credentialed people. And that is how you become brilliant in their minds. You need to memorize these things from these, Neil deGrasse Tyson and Jared Lange, the kind of the simulacrum of, I mean, these are such frauds. These are such stand-ins for, the true substance that used to occupy those positions. Learning that somebody is a Harvard graduate now, for example, I just immediately feel suspicion and disgust, not even an ounce of respect. I mean, it used to be growing up that when I heard something like that, I would think, oh, okay, wow, this person may have some interesting things to say, certainly probably has a capable mind, etc. And there would be immediate respect granted accordingly in the back of my mind. But truly, at this point, it is the opposite. When I hear something like that, I'm immediately suspecting not only is this person, horribly indoctrinated, which is virtually a guarantee, but are they also borderline retarded? And that's tended to be a guarantee, too.
I think that this touches on something I've mentioned before in a few streams on this millennial, that the apparatus that people shoot, because obviously most people are not good at, and this sounds like self-aggrandizement. I don't mean it that way. I'm just trying to observe the situation. Most people are not independent thinkers. They're not very good at independent. Certainly when it comes to social culture issues, they just don't, they default to whatever is the norm, whatever is the consensus. So in the past and in any functional society, there is an apparatus peopled by individuals who are good at thinking. And that apparatus generates consensus, it generates fashionable ideas and so on, that are workable, ideas that are true, broadly speaking, or at least true enough. But the problem now is we have an elite, an apparatus generating consensus that is completely false and will induce illness. And so those people are charlatans.
Now, absolutely.
And obviously we can moan about the charlatans, but the issue is not, I mean, that won't get us anywhere. I wish it would, because I could moan all day about it.
Well, this is something I wanted to touch on briefly, is that I speak negatively often about the quote elite class, and academia is definitely included. But I always want to make sure that nobody thinks that I'm talking about the structure, the hierarchical structure that cultivates and creates an elite class, because that's absolutely necessary. A culture and a society needs a class of individuals to be the shepherds in various spheres, to be the best and brightest in their, individual sphere, and to use that talent fruitfully. everything depends on that. In fact, I would say the healthiest societies all throughout history are the healthiest precisely because they have a healthy hierarchical structure and elites that are truly elite. And our problem is not the fact that there are elites. There's some populist line of thinking that we should, you know, banish all hierarchy across the board. I completely disagree with that. It's a minor subset, but it definitely exists on the right. But we just need our elites to be elite again. It's really that simple. And currently they are the epitome of the opposite.
Yes. Almost they're completely
laughable and embarrassing and
charlatans. I mean, corrupt. They're completely failing in their job.
Yeah.
And I agree that you need an elite. I mean, you just cannot have a society or a human grouping without hierarchy.
Absolutely.
And it's just not going to happen. So you have to have an elite. And I think that people who rail against that, I mean, you know, we have our own spiteful mutants, even on our side, that there are people who hate that some other people are better than them. And I understand why, but it's, you know, I mean, everyone's good at something, for God's sake. Take solace in what you are good at.
I hate to interrupt you, but if there's one impulse we can all work on quashing, I hope it's that envy and that resentment, as Nietzsche would say, resentment, that kind of festers in many people. It is just such a net negative across the board.
Oh, yeah.
But I just want to say,
terrible. Yeah. So the issue is that we need to either influence the current elite, some faction within them, or replace them in time.
Yeah.
But there will always be an elite. And I think it's an absolute pipe dream to suggest otherwise.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think we need to get started on creating our own hierarchies anywhere and everywhere, because those currently involved with the elite hierarchies are the end result of decades of the most, let's say, selfish, self-interested, greedy, amoral, unethical. And of course, I'm speaking broadly. There are many exceptions, but broadly speaking, this is absolutely true. So in other words, it's almost been something of a selection of some of the worst humanity has to offer. So I don't even want to win them over, even if we could. And I don't think that even if we could, and even if they truly could be won over, I don't think that's the best path to take. I think there's tremendous value in separating from that type, because that type requires so much work and so much effort to even bring them back to square one, let alone, you know, educate them on the things that they've been missing out on all these years.
The current elite, I mean, there's so much. I don't think that you could reprogram them, even if they were amenable to it.
They're too far gone. They are the tip of the spear of degeneration and sickness and poison. So, they are on the other polar opposite end of the playing field.
But actually, as I say that, I'm thinking, hold on a minute. What about during COVID, when suddenly they hated an entire new class of people, the unvaccinated? It's difficult, isn't it? Because again, a new consensus, and suddenly they all switch. And you know, the elite, the academic, just as much as the commoner garden NPC.
I would say that the battle lines were still drawn roughly in the same manner, though, for the most part. I mean, with a lot of exceptions, but the elite class was still immediately the class calling for, you know, masks and forced vaccination, etc., and mocking others. It almost seemed like more of the same in a way, but It was a fantastic example of just how far gone they are and how we're being destroyed by an elite class that doesn't deserve that title. Truly destroyed. I mean, they are the standard bearers of this chaotic cesspool that we're sprinting toward.
Yeah. One thing that interests me is how we got from progressivism See, this actually, we were going to address how the world has changed since you were, since you last appeared on Millennial in 2018. Yeah. And I guess the a good way to approach that topic would be, how did we get from sort of, let's say, 90s individualism and progressivism to in the 2000s and 2010s to this weird soft totalitarianism now, where, well, definitely authoritarianism.
Yeah.
Would you agree that there has been a transition there?
I would. And I think that they push as far as they can, meaning as far as they can get away with. And institutional capture was so successful over the past decade or so that it's just opened up a world of opportunities, I think. So COVID, I think, was used to masterful effect, but race as well, in so many different ways, has been used to masterful effect. Immigration, they knew that they essentially had a green light because they were so successful with institutional capture that it's like being the banker in Monopoly, having the total power to, they knew that they had monopolistic power over the culture and over where it was headed. And to the extent that they felt that monopolistic power, they were going to use it to the maximum of its ability, and they have been. So I think it's almost like a vice or a noose has been slowly closing on every front and broadly speaking. So yeah, I think that is what's been happening over the past 4 or so years to an accelerated degree. We definitely, everything seems to be exponentially increasing in pace, which is pretty incredible to think about, because if these trends continue, I mean, we're just headed for something we can't imagine. But
yeah,
hopefully we can be ready to pick up the pieces. And
yeah, I mean, I think the
create side avenues as well.
Yeah, I think the takeaway here, so to speak, is that we do need to create institutions that not only rival the mainstream, but can withstand whatever the mainstream could do to it, and also withstand the chaos that's coming. Earlier, you alluded to, I wrote it down, a period of chaos coming in the next decade. Do you want to go into that?
Well, I'm not sure how fruitful it would be, because I don't have specifics. I have a lot of educated guesses as to what that might mean. But even some of those are awkward territory. I think things are going to collapse at free fall speed, and that I suspect this collapse is part of the plan, that they will seek to be, let's say, the powers that be and the true movers and shakers behind the scenes at the moment, those with truly the most power and influence in our world. I think the plan is to create order out of chaos again, or attempt to do so. And so I think chaos is kind of a requisite step, which is something that we all need to keep foremost in mind. Because I mentioned the other day, I'm not sure if it was on Twitter or Gab, I think it was on Gab, the belief and the idea, the feeling that it's as if they're poking a bear with a stick over and over and over, and they know full well at some point that bear needs to take a swipe, that it'll stand up for itself and defend itself at some point. And I think that that is baked into, let's call it a plan, for lack of a better word. I think they're trying to make that happen, because this is part. And of course, that doesn't help us much. In fact, that only leaves us with kind of bad options, because we can't sit and do nothing. We can't sit and not take a swipe and just be snuffed out like a candle over time. But we need to know that any reaction is something that they're likely planning for on every level. And I hope everyone will keep that in mind and begin to think accordingly. And the video I release after the new year will hopefully clarify in a much more optimistic way. I hate to be a bit of a downer, but anyway, I think that they're poking as hard and as often as they possibly can, very much hoping that, for example, lone wolves will do terrible things to hopefully innocent people that they can use as grist for their media mills. But I do definitely think that they're attempting to provoke a reaction. And
see, that's interesting because I haven't, it's funny how you get into habits of thinking and then you assume that the habit of thinking that you're currently in is the correct one. And I haven't been in the habit of thinking along the lines that you're saying. I've got into the habit of thinking that they are reacting to things as they happen and rather somewhat struggling to keep a lid on everything, and that the elites who are currently in charge are really are in charge and are the only ones that are sort of available. And what you seem to be saying is that they're engineering a crisis so as to enhance their own power, to enhance the grasp they have in society.
It's almost as if both are true. In other words, I think that they are trying to keep a lid on things, but they know full well that at the end of this script, in other words, I think that they know beyond any shadow of a doubt that they're not going to attain their aims without a fight and without a serious fight. So I would put it that simply. That's kind of the best summary, I think. So they have been the ones that have, when I say they, we can imagine institutions like the WEF, for example, that actually meet behind closed doors and openly, and they create plans of action, detailed plans of action, international plans of action. So I think that they know full well that a reaction is coming. And I think that this is a key part of the larger plan. And like I said, it's a depressing thought because we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. There is definite reason for hope and optimism, in my opinion, because not all reactions are created equal, and there are ways to extricate ourselves without handing them on a silver platter what they want and what I think they need. I think that, for example, most of us would admit that there's probably been a fair amount of false flags and FBI grooming of mentally unwell people to do things that they shouldn't, doing everything they possibly can to kind of pad the statistics of supposed far-right terrorism and white nationalism. All of this is to create the groundwork and create a narrative for what's coming. But I think they've been disappointed at how few people have taken the bait, if I'm being honest. So I think they need much, much more, certainly to justify a serious crackdown. And I hope everyone will keep this in mind, because if people got angry enough to where individuals were doing, you know, indiscriminate attacks and whatnot, that is the worst possible thing that could be done at this point. We gain nothing from that, and we risk losing everything.
And the system knows exactly how to use that, as it's shown repeatedly.
Yes. Any one real instance amidst their, you know, sea of false flags and manufactured instances, any one real instance will be used nonstop across, you know, media. The January 6th is an example. Of course, that wasn't, in my opinion, a wholly real and genuine incident. It was largely contrived and manufactured. But even still, it shows you how much they will milk and use it for all it's worth, any instance like that that they can cause to occur.
So
it's a very real threat.
So what would you say? I know that you're obviously a deep thinker, theoretical, and so on. perhaps not someone who is comfortable giving practical advice, but people will be wondering, while they're listening to us talking about these very abstract matters, people will be wondering, well, what should be done? What should we do? Of course, one thing here is maybe we are not the people who should do what will be done. You know, maybe we're not the men of action. I don't know. What would you say to that?
Well, depending on what you're asking, I think that individuals should focus on their own health first and foremost, because you can't really put something out into the world unless it arises from within you. So physical, mental, and spiritual health, but in the fundamental senses, not in this, you know, self-care type surface layer, modern fad. Return to the things that you know intuitively work for you, and do whatever you can to keep a cool head and keep your sanity, and realize that we do have paths to take in the future. And it's an artful balance again between patience and a sense of immediacy. And there's no perfect way to strike that balance. You need both. You can't have people who are indefinitely patient who sit around and do nothing until the inevitable happens. But too much of a sense of immediacy, it has so many negative effects. It can cause you to go a bit crazy, become a bit frenetic, and also do stupid things. So to quote the disgraced Jordan Peterson, we do need to kind of clean our rooms and keep them clean insofar as possible. But most of this I'll be speaking to in the video I keep referencing. But there are ways we can step aside as groups and create the type of atmosphere and environment that we're seeking, at least on small scales that can eventually develop into more. But I would say this is the biggest thing, is don't embrace that pessimism and nihilism. Realize that our biggest limitation, and it sounds cliche to say, but it is absolutely true, our biggest limitations are those we place on ourselves, and it's a complete lack of imagination. You could even say a lack of courage. But we get into this mindset that we can only use the structures that exist and the means and methods that currently exist to right this ship and fix the problem. That could be completely not the case. Virtually everything that we currently live within, whether it be our democratic structure or economic structure, whatever the case may be, these things can and will collapse utterly. There's no telling when, and there's no telling which of them, but we're entering a period of, in my opinion, and I believe this very strongly, of tremendous upheaval, to where huge things can happen overnight. So believing that present trends are bound to continue, believing that we need to win democratic elections, believing that we need to win 51% or more of the population, all of these things are different delusions that, in my view, are completely unnecessary. And I hope to convince people of this in the coming months and I hope to show some concrete solutions, and I hope that people will share my enthusiasm, because there are several ways out of this. And anybody that's saying that things are absolutely hopeless, they're just really not thinking, in my opinion. They're limiting themselves to such an extent that they may as well not be thinking. It's an embarrassing lack of vision and judgment. And
I mean, look,
sense of possibility.
What I would say about this is there are people who are minded towards certain ways of thinking, inclined towards, you know, I'm famously quite melancholic, not really a man of action. And there are people who are different types. And so I think that people shouldn't berate themselves for lacking vision or whatever. I mean,
yeah, no, that's true.
You can look retrospectively at some event or some creation and realize that not many people probably would have thought of that creation until it happened. Until
you don't have to be the one with a vision, but at least don't piss on that. You know what I'm saying? I hate to use vulgar language. Don't be the person who brings a dark cloud into that because you've somehow convinced yourself that all of this is impossible. Because anybody that knows some history knows that nearly everybody that has said such and such is impossible has ended up looking completely foolish, because we can only view the world that we currently live in. It's almost impossible for us to view either past or future and envision what that could look like. But we need to start doing a lot more of that right now, because we are not going to be living within the same structures and within the same type of environment and atmosphere that we are now. Things are going to change. And I think that we should be a key element of that change, and that we can be, at least for ourselves, but very likely for large swaths of territory. I'll put it that way for now.
Yeah. And of course, we want to be in as good a position to take advantage of opportunities when they arise. Yes. I think that's obvious. And so, people who are going to be, who are optimized for leadership or whatever, should be training, should be learning about that kind of thing now. I completely agree.
And one more quick point. Also, we spoke of the herd-like impulse and how not everybody should be expected to have a broad vision and whatnot. I completely agree. And even the herd-like impulse itself has been healthy at many points in history. It's a necessary element of our thinking. Because if every single person was a completely independent critical thinker, pardon me, they would be spiraling out into 100,000 different directions at once, and society would be absolute chaos as a result. So the element that the herd-like element was well guided and well shepherded by a healthy and well-oriented class of elites in the past, in my opinion. And that is exactly how it should be. And that herd-like element allowed for people to accomplish great things accordingly. Being herd-like essentially means you're outsourcing certain tasks to other people. And when you're outsourcing those tasks to people who are truly deserving of fulfilling them, you're doing something positive. So the herd-like idea, we all like to dismiss it and disparage it. And I mean, with good reason for the most part, because it's also destroying us. But it's destroying us because the herd is following a completely corrupt and degenerate pseudo-elite.
Yeah, and that is the whole problem. I mean, I think, and I've said this on my own show, that the problem is not that there's an elite. The problem is that we're not it.
That's true.
Those of us who, I'm not against hierarchy. I said this earlier. It's the frustration comes from that it's some other group who are in charge,
and I have no desire to
society.
And I have no desire, and I think many of us don't have a desire to forcibly impose on anyone. Certainly, a very different type of person. I don't want to force people of different races and religions to believe and do exactly as I say, etc. But I'm not going to sit back and allow, and nobody should, others to do the same to us. And that's really the end of it. I mean, we need to be our own elites within our own circles. And when our own elites are people who despise us and are completely unworthy of that role, I mean, the situation doesn't get much sicker and much more malformed than that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is part of what's so difficult to believe, is that they really don't have our best interest. It's kind of like I think a lot of us, certainly myself, are kind of inclined to believe that things probably are roughly as they should be. And so it's continually a shock for me to realize that they're really not. And I can understand the facts. I can understand the words, and I believe it, and I have believed it for years. But it just continually gets me that, oh my God, these, like, Justin Trudeau actually really likes this situation.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's not even
close to them having our best interests at heart. I mean, not even close to being close. That's so far out of the picture. A lot of them do relish it. And those that don't relish it, they're just automatons kind of carrying out their script and their orders. So they're kind of completely uncaring. So it's either a proactive hatred or just an uncaring apathy. But it's one of the two in almost every instance. Like I said, the current batch of elites have essentially been selected for their negative qualities, in my opinion. And once again, I'm speaking broadly, and there are tons of exceptions. But speaking broadly, this is true.
Yeah. I wonder if there is anything else to say about that. I don't want to leave people on a negative note. And I think it's important that people realize I am not, Ashalogos is not preaching inaction or passivity or despair, and neither am I. I think the really important thing is to concentrate on what you can influence and be realistic about that, because otherwise you're just going to trip yourself up. This doesn't mean anything more than those words, actually.
I think I'm probably holding back on my elaboration and explanation a bit just because I want so much of it to be in the video form after the new year. But there really is a tremendous reason to be positive. And if we only knew just how bad things currently are, because it's like the slow boiling of a frog. You can lose sight of just how terrible things have become because it's been so incremental.
Yes.
But there is virtually no way to make things worse. And there is almost an infinite amount of potential progress in the other direction. And we have all of that stretching before us. We only need to learn how to take those steps and sprint in that direction. And I have some ideas on that front.
Certainly, I'll look forward to hearing that. Do you think that men, maybe I'm going to inadvertently spoil your video, I hope not, but do you have the feeling that there are elements within the elite who are becoming amenable to our ideas?
Yeah, I definitely see that. It's a minority, because like I said, I think that they were very effectively selected. I mean, even these blackmail operations, for example, think about what they're doing. They're finding the people who are willing to be the most amoral and unethical, things like pedophilia, for example. So they're finding people who have just completely sold their souls. And when you find someone like that, and especially when you have them in your control, they will do anything. There's no rule book they need to abide by. So I think that's an extreme example of the selection process. But broadly speaking, there has been such a selection process that just a terrible patch of people now occupy those offices. But there always are exceptions. And many of them, I think, for many years have kept their heads down. I mean, I've been reached out to by so many of these types who have done everything in their power to not show their power level, as we say, to not tell others what they know, and to not rock the boat, maybe not sell their souls and maybe not compromise themselves too much, but not rock the boat. And I think now many of those people are starting to stand up and come to light. And I think they have a short window of time in which they might be able to salvage or feel like they're salvaging, whether it be the United States as a nation, whether it be political or economic structures, some sense of normality. They have a short window in which they could try to keep this this thing running and improve it a bit. But that doesn't intrigue me. I think that we need radical change at this point in so many different spheres. So I think that keeping it limping along, it almost bothers me. The Tim Pool attitude, especially the kind of centrist moderate, just I feel kind of disgust for. But even Elon, which would be another fascinating topic for another day, you can tell that he doesn't know a great deal about
anything.
Well, I would say certainly the corruption and the conspiracy at play and the political machinations, he's just now learning and learning quickly, but it kind of surprised me. I mean, you always think that people at those levels, they have to yes. at least understand a fair bit. But he seemed relatively clueless, and he still does to a large extent. He does this centrist thing that Tim Pool also does, and Jordan Peterson does often too, but where they think that both sides are the problem, both extreme ends, and the centrist path or the moderate path is the way that we save the day. That is just not the case anymore. I mean, all you're doing is normalizing poison, I would say, when you're taking that centrist path. At this point, we're so deeply poisoned that we do need something very significant and very real.
I mean, when you've got Drag Queen Story Hour,
yes,
it's not.
Yeah.
If that's the norm, if that's normal, if that's, and it is, it actually is now, then yeah, you're not in ordinary times anymore.
With armed guards at the door, by the way, armed Antifa guards,
God.
allowing this predatory behavior against children to happen. It's beyond disgusting. There are certain things that I can't talk about on social media and whatnot, because I'm already kind of nearing the line often, and I know that I know my personality. This is one of the reasons why I've tried so hard throughout most of my life to foster this sense of empathy, because I knew that if I didn't, I would end up, you know, dead or in jail in short order, just because when you see what these people are willing to do, and when you see that often it's fueled by pure malevolence, so it's not just they've picked up some strange intellectual ideas. I mean, that often happens, yes, but there is a branch of them, and they seem to be taking the fore now, that are truly led by something dark. And we're going to look back on this one day and look at all that we tolerated and all that we sat by and watched happen. And we're just going to be shocked and disgusted with ourselves, I think.
Yeah. If that does happen, I think it's important that we also remember the pressures that we were living under in this time, how dangerous it was to put your head above the parapet on anything. Yeah. You know, you can ruin your life, and ultimately everyone is an animal, has needs, has biological needs, you have to try to protect yourself. So it's understandable why. I mean, the thing that always gets me is
there's Robin. Endless self-justifications.
I know, but they are real concerns. I mean, yeah. With Rotherham, everyone always says, why didn't the men of the town do something? Well, it's a bloody good question, but it's extremely, you know, the answer is sort of sobering.
It's definitely difficult and costly, and it could cost a person everything. I mean, we need to understand that there's a real fight ahead. Not everyone needs to be involved in the most direct and, you know, frontline way, but almost certainly we will need to learn to create red lines and stand by them and enforce them. That's the only way that this tide turns. But when we learn to do that, when even a small amount, even a handful of people truly learn to do that, but I suspect that if done properly, it'll spread like wildfire. Everything can change very quickly. I mean, history proves this time and time again. It does not take, you know, 20 or 30% of the population to manifest incredible change. It can be a much smaller amount.
And I think this gets to the heart of what we were saying earlier about the centrist. The centrist is kind of is optimized for a world where everything's basically okay, and so we don't need any extreme ideas. Why would you go for extreme? It'd be crazy. We just need the normal, and that just doesn't work anymore. And what they don't seem to understand is that history is not made of the norm just continuing and happening again and again and again. History is made of rather colorful things happening and colorful forces that aren't very polite. You know, they're quite aggressive, and I'm not saying anything. I'm just talking about history as a trend. So the centrist who's hoping that everything will just be peaceful and nice. I mean,
it's
that's
such
never
a delusion, been, such a profound delusion.
It's such a state of comfort, you know, and luxury.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's like that quote, being well adjusted to a sick society is no measure of health. I'm not doing it verbatim justice, but that always springs to mind, because those who try to kind of thread the gap, and they try to play that kind of fence-sitting role in so many different ways, they're doing such a disservice, because they really are attempting to normalize a great deal of this poison, maybe not intending to, but that's the end result effect. You can't say that, you can't help them normalize things like predatory behavior against children. I mean, there's zero room for that, and there needs to be zero room for that in whatever is created after this. And that needs to be, there need to be sets of firm red lines that aren't crossed. And anybody who would take a centrist or moderate position in the face of issues like that is absolutely not worthy of respect.
What centrist moderate position is there?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, the extremes are diverging so much that, yeah, you'd be, if you tried to ride that fence, you'd be doing the split and rip in half. Because that's absolutely true. Exactly. And this is another thing we're telling. So Jordan Peterson, one of the best things he's ever said, is that the thing that needs to be done in the coming years is that we need to tell a better story. And I think this applies to us too, in our ranks. I think it showed a pretty firm understanding of the broader picture. We simply need to learn to tell a better story. And there are two stories developing, two storylines, which is why we're headed towards probably an explosion, because we're headed in such polar opposite directions. And two is, of course, my chosen framework. One could conceivably say, you know, 3, 4, 10, whatever. But I think fundamentally the most valuable and fruitful framework would be that there are two that we are slowly starting to realize and recognize and feel out and understand, and that we are headed in opposite directions. Opposite.
When you say two, there are two storylines developing, do you mean that there are two visions for the future, one progressivist, globalist? What do you mean?
I would say something even larger than that, meaning at a almost kind of spiritual, on the deepest levels. So one aspect of this would be the fact that, for example, roughly half of the people, I think it's less than that now, but they have some faith that things are pretty much going as they should. They still watch media, maybe with some skepticism, but they'll watch CNN, MSNBC, they'll watch their Netflix, they'll watch their standard entertainment, and web content, et cetera. And they trust the experts, by and large. They were the people who wore the masks and immediately took the jab, et cetera. And there are another branch of people who feel like they have reason to be deeply skeptical. So I think that's one of the biggest examples of a clean rift that almost separates us in half. And it's such a fundamental rift, because when half of the people are trusting the experts and the media and the establishment storyline, and the other half is scrambling to find a storyline, they're very, very different cultures and groups developing on every level, in every sphere. They are very different.
I agree. I mean, this is an alternative future here. As earlier on, we said that, you know, the progressives, the NPCs and so on, the liberals will join us when that is the consensus to believe in the things.
Whenever it becomes easy and
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Safe. But an alternative is that, as you just said just now, we're actually developing into almost two different life forms. I mean, when I think of that girl I mentioned earlier, I don't know. I felt that we were so different that I in the end I didn't meet up with her.
Yeah,
you know, haven't seen her, haven't met her since 2006 or something.
I think many of us.
And in the end, I decided not to do it, because I just thought, well, we're not going to have anything to see.
Yeah. So. And it is, we're developing into two different life forms. I mean, how far that can go in kind of a genetic and physical context without us, you know, creating a big wall, physically separating us and not having internet and et cetera contact is debatable. But on every other level, on every other fundamental level, we are really going in, I mean, like I said, polar opposite directions. And it's getting to the point where our language means something completely different to the other person's ear. You can say the same words and they can mean something completely different to the person on the other side of that ideological fence, which means a complete breakdown in communication, which means that the merging of our storylines becomes essentially impossible, which means the only thing left is conflict, almost certainly. I mean, any miracle could happen. But if you do buy the premise that there are certain vested interests who are attempting to push us in to something like a globalist empire, and that they have an immense amount of wealth and power and people in influential positions all across the world, and they have obviously a plan of action. If the rest of that is true, then obviously they have a plan. And we see several elements of that plan, I would say, in things like the WEF documents. Then what that means is that there will be a fight. Either we raise the white flag and be cowards and become extinguished and a remnant of history, or there's a battle. And I know for a fact it's going to be the latter.
All right. Okay, well, on that note, then, I guess we should go to the questions.
Sure.
Okay.
I wish I could have been more sunny. I did want to say happy winter solstice to everybody. And
yes.
The shortest day of the year. And also, where I am, the coldest day of the year, most likely. Nearly record-setting temps. And a Merry Christmas when Christmas comes around.
Okay, all right. Thank you for that. We'll get to that. You know, there's a chance for a more upbeat thing at the end. So don't worry about that. We can just answer the questions for now, and then we'll get to that.
I think people will see the upside and in the dark side and in the downsides that we've discussed. Because
I hope so.
Yes, there is a light at the end of that tunnel and a dawn at the end of that darkness.
Yeah. Yes. I think there has to be. Otherwise, you might as well just say, okay, it's all over. And I can't really fool that idea. I have to believe that that something good is going to come of all this. I have to believe that.
It will.
And you know, some people say that's copium, but I also think it, well, kind of, but it's also just like it's necessity that I'm choosing to take that attitude.
And it is the healthy thing, but it's also the accurate and right thing, in my opinion. I strongly believe that.
Yeah. But I mean, this could be the struggle of the ages.
Yeah.
This could probably will be historic. It probably will be unprecedented, unique. But that doesn't mean, that doesn't mean it's impossible. In fact, in a way, you could say that the higher the stakes are, the worse the situation is, the more precarious it all is, then the more galvanized we'll be.
Absolutely. And
I would like to think that's the truth.
Absolutely.
All right. There are quite a few from No Chance, so thank you for that. He says, Asha Logos, this is very complimentary to you. Asha Logos has an angelic wisdom that truly changes a viewer into rethinking their worldview and makes one ashamed of modernity but proud of the past. How do we spread the message that should be viral but is suppressed with online censorship?
Well, I appreciate that. Never feel quite worthy of those types of compliments. So can you read that last line one more time? The question part specifically?
Yes.
So I didn't get it specifically.
How do we spread the message that should be viral but is suppressed with online censorship?
Well, I think that we talked earlier about creating a positive and kind of comfy and wholesome environment and atmosphere. I think that there's an art to virtually everything in life, whether it be speaking or writing or reading or anything and everything. In fact, the broader you go, I mean, you could say that everything in life, essentially. And there's an art to communicating these ideas in a way that is maximally impactful and fruitful and will gain purchase in the hearts and minds. And I think we all have an intuitive guide to an extent as to what that is. I mean, in many ways, many of the things are just readily obvious. You don't want to be off-putting. You don't want to be crude and immature. You want to be the type of person that you would want to be around. You want to speak in that type of way. But also think of the type of thing that you would be swayed by. Think of the type of argument that would make the most sense to you. Try to avoid the most obvious red flags that have been planted by subversive parties in the minds of so many. There are certain people that when they hear certain words, they either immediately check out of the conversation or they immediately shift into defensive mode and or attack mode, which are sometimes one and the same. And if you can learn to kind of sidestep those and be maybe a bit subtle, that helps tremendously. But you need to find, I think, the root of what you're trying to communicate that is most important to you, and then find the best way to communicate that root to the minds of others and minds that may be, like I said, full of red flags and full of booby traps and various mechanisms placed there by subversive parties. I hope that answers the question to an extent.
Yeah, I agree. It's a matter of boiling it down to the most to the essential thing. Don't and never get bogged down with details or statistics.
Oh, absolutely.
Just doesn't
work. Such a mistake.
And also try to lead people by asking them questions.
Yes, that's good. You want them to think. I mean, I hate to think of it as a manipulative tactic, but I mean, in a way, it could be viewed as that. But you want, if somebody can think and come to an idea or a realization themselves, it is so much more powerful than you trying to do that work for them. The lesson is imbibed much more deeply and embraced much more foundationally. So it's always a far better approach when the person can come to the realization themselves, because otherwise it may be a superficial realization that they just simply toss off next time it's fashionable to hold the opposite realization. Definitely a good point.
Yeah. Well, one thing I would also say is ration your time. Don't, this sounds bad, but consider whether it's with each particular person.
Oh, absolutely.
Is it worth the effort and time? Because a lot of it will be frustration. Do you want to subject yourself to that if the payoff isn't going to be worth it?
People need to stop banging their heads against brick walls that aren't going to yield. There are certain people that you are not going to reach, and certain people that there may be some slight glimmer of hope, but it's so distant and so faded that unless they're a family member or a very close friend that you love immensely, it's best to just walk on past. And
yeah,
energy conservation. I would love to elaborate on that idea, but it's so important for us right now because we are being drained and exhausted on every front. And when you try to reach every single person you meet and constantly experience that, that negative feedback that likely comes from that, and that judgmental and people getting the wrong idea of who you are and why you're doing what you're doing and et cetera, it can just be devastating in the long term. So
exactly. It's important to learn. Yeah. It's important to learn the right lessons from things, but therefore it's important to do things that will not teach you the wrong lessons. In other words, don't set yourself up for failure. There's no point. So if something is probably, inevitably, likely going to be a failure, don't even do it. That's not to say to be afraid of failure. I'm just saying to conserve your resources so that you don't end up being burned and then demoralized. So don't try to red pill someone who it's probably not going to happen.
There are certain types of failures that you can embrace because they don't have an extreme energy cost to them. And in fact, they may have a net positive benefit down the line. But this type of failure, especially with human interaction, if you're constantly experiencing this type of failure, it's just going to be immensely draining and you're not going to be happy with your life.
Exactly. And the kind of people I was thinking of that it's probably a bad idea to try to red pill them is older people because they're very much stuck in their ways. They don't want to change. In some ways, they're too old to change. And also, they don't want to learn that they've believed a lot of rubbish for 60 years or 70 years. No one wants to hear that.
A younger person. I mean, that's usually part of the dynamic, too.
Yes, I hadn't thought of that. That's true as well.
You're trying to completely change their kind of fundamental views, and you're half their age. It's got to be a bit jarring and a bit
galling.
Their defenses are riled, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. And would it benefit you? That's the other thing. Yeah. I can be selfish about this and think, would it benefit me if this old boomer becomes aware of certain things?
Perhaps if not. We're really being utilitarian about it, and we do need to be to some degree, you should probably be paying attention to what types of people you're trying to win over. Because, yeah, you could go to an old folks home with people, you know, 2 weeks from death's door, and spend time with them. That's fantastic. But if you're attempting to politically convert them and thinking that something is going to come of it, you're probably barking up the wrong tree.
I mean, at least you'd have a captive audience. You know, they, they wouldn't be able to just walk away. But that's obviously sick. It would be
it's
the
funny,
wrong
but approach. It's also sick, yes.
Yeah, it would be the wrong approach. So I would say younger people, and people, and also people that it wouldn't damage you, it wouldn't harm you if they just refuse, if they just disagree, you know.
And you need to keep that in mind always when going into it, when going into any situation like that. Think of the worst case scenario. I mean, am I potentially going to be sacrificing a friendship or, you know, a relationship with a family member or whatever the case may be, and approach accordingly? I mean, take as much risk as you're willing to take with that in mind. Because, yeah, it could cost you that relationship, or it could simply lead to an incredibly negative reaction that, if you're kind of an insecure person or a neurotic person, could kind of stay with you and nest in your subconscious and
prey on you. Yes. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So set yourself up to learn the right lessons, to learn the helpful lessons, not the unhelpful lessons. I think that's a very good piece of advice for life in general.
Yes.
All right. Okay. I'm not sure I can pronounce that name, but it begins with Windu. Asha Logos and Vertigo Politics have the most artfully done videos articulating the problems plaguing the West. The right needs more highbrow content like this, which belongs in a curriculum for our children. Keep doing what you do. You're a big inspiration.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Very nice comment there. No Chance asks, what future subverted history topics are you interested in? I also learned from you about General Patton's final comments on fighting the wrong enemy. Will this be a future video? Future subverted history topics.
I would say at the very end of the subverted history video's journey or path, we will probably talk about Patton and that era, I would suspect. But I generally, as I finish a video, for example, right now, and I don't think I've announced this yet, have I? Maybe I did at the starting. There will be a video released within the next couple of days. First, just to my Subscribestar supporters, because I feel like I do so little for them, and I constantly feel badly about that. So first it'll go to them, but then just a day or two later, I'll release it to the public. And I am almost certain that I can complete both videos, so part one and part two, before the new year. So hopefully that's something to look forward to. But as I come to the completion of something like this French Revolution video, I certainly don't have two or three or four topics in mind looking ahead. I generally don't even have the next topic in mind. I'm so engrossed in what I'm working on, and I kind of like to take stock at the end and think, okay, what is the most valuable step next? I definitely have an overall arc where I'm headed, but the specifics of how I get there is very much up for grabs, and it could go in a multitude of different directions.
Okay. Next question is from No Chance. Would you do a live stream with Owen Benjamin? I think there's an overlapping audience.
Possibly. I mean, I tend to not like live streams and interviews very much. I think Norm Macdonald was the one who said it. I can't recall specifically, but he said something about how he couldn't think quickly, but he did think deeply. In other words, he wasn't the type of person that, long story short, since we're probably short on time, I love to be able to get my thoughts on paper because I can slowly, you know, perfect and refine and massage them into into what I know they should be. And it's much, much more difficult, of course, to do that in a free-flowing conversation. There's benefit and value to both, but right now I know that this is the ideal path for me, and it pretty much takes up all of my time. It's a possibility, definitely. But I tend to like directing all of my work into the types of finished products that you've all seen in the past.
Yes, I think those of course.
The most fruitful. Well,
I mean, this is why I've taken a certain attitude with you, which differs from some of my other guests, where I'm not asking you, okay, so what's this? And tell us about this. Because obviously you're not going to respond well to that. And that attitude, that tone came naturally as we began speaking. But I think it's important to say that you don't need to feel pressured. I mean, I tend to think that, a conversation like this is best when there isn't a sense of time pressure, when you don't feel, oh, I've got to answer that pretty damn quickly. He's waiting for an answer. Oh, my God. Because that's obviously going to be ridiculous. And I don't think that the audience would enjoy that either. When it's someone like you, they know what to expect. So I don't think you need to worry about it. Because as you said, these conversations can be very helpful. You know, they can help to...
They definitely have their upsides, yeah.
Yeah, to speak about something, to verbalize it, is to clarify it in a way that might not come through, thought alone.
I may end up doing live streams, possibly from time to time. But what I'm even more likely to do is, lately I've just been building a fire, like I'm doing now, sitting by the fire, and bringing up my very long list of kind of seed notes for future videos and future podcasts, which are kind of like bullet points that I then elaborate on. And simply talking. So I have a ton of recorded content now, and I'll find avenues to get that out. But I've thought of even scheduling, an hour or two each night, so that I could just have something regular. Because my podcast, everything I've been doing lately, has been so sporadic. This would be a much more free flowing kind of conversation and waltz of. Ideological waltz, but it wouldn't be as targeted and as concise and as direct, but there's some value in that and some interesting things come from that, so it's a possibility.
Okay, and then No Chance also asks, where do you recommend to get your news from? Do you like to hear from Vox Day, Gonzalo Lira, or Pete Cannoni?
I don't have any one source. I mean, there are probably on any given week maybe 100 different sources. I cast the widest net I could possibly cast, and that includes social media, which, I mean, if you think of the number of different people breaking news, that's a massive number. So I kind of just wander through all of that, and there's a few people I gravitate towards, but virtually none of them, it's kind of head and shoulders above the rest to where I would feel confident given a name. So yeah, I can't help much there. I don't think I can provide a very good response.
Okay, that's fine. I mean, I wouldn't know how to answer that question either, to be honest. Yeah. When somebody asks you, where do you get your news from? It's kind of difficult to think of all the sources because there are so many. Caesar himself says, your videos are great, but your Alexander video in particular was outstanding. Looking forward to your next. Cheers.
I appreciate that. Okay. The next should be up in about 3 or 4 days for the public.
Okay. And then someone whose name I'd rather not read out loud says, great streams, Woz. Have a good Christmas. Thank you very much. VerbVids says, Ashalogos, do you know of the conspiracy that Shakespeare wasn't a writer and his plays were written by several other people?
Yes, I'm very aware of that whole dynamic and that whole mystery and storyline. So yes, it's a fascinating one, definitely. And there's some substance to it, I think.
Martin Lichtmes is an ardent believer in the Oxfordian thesis that Shakespeare was not the man. Well, the plays were not written by the man we think. I think it was Christopher Marlowe. I can't remember the name. Yeah. He's quite ardent about it. But
interesting.
I don't and I have no opinion on it. And I also, you know, I understand it's useful for people who are historians. But for me, the literature is what matters.
Yeah.
And actually, it doesn't, like, you could tell me, you know, in actual fact, it was an anonymous washerwoman who
that mystery would be superficially interesting, but it wouldn't really get you anywhere. So.
Exactly. It's like, it doesn't actually matter to me whether it was that guy, William Shakespeare, that we've all seen the image of, or if it was someone else.
I mean,
the plays are what matter.
Yeah. And considering he did just completely revamp the English language and wrote some of the most incredible works of all time, there is a lot of interest and intrigue that's justified. But yeah, it's not like solving it could bring us many steps closer to any fruitful goal, I don't think.
Exactly. So I mean, as I say, I understand why it's of interest and, you know, burning interest to people who are interested in the history of things. But as someone who's more interested in the literature side of it, it's really neither here nor there for me. Okay, North Wind says, Ashalogos, are people used to use bards to carry the history and stories? Have you come across any modern equivalent? Reading history books is fine, but it can be dry and lack soul.
Yeah.
So bards and the power of storytelling.
I would say that I definitely have a few, and maybe in the future, the near future, I'll try to publicly mention some of those names to varying degrees of power behind their words and their work. But yeah, I think I see and I feel intuitively a resurgence of that. I think that when a certain archetypal energy gets kind of quashed and pushed aside and diminished and nearly destroyed, I think deep inside the right sorts of people is a feeling that it needs to return. And I think that it naturally does so. I think that it's almost as if we have a certain amount of archetypes that continually recur. And when you push one to the side or attempt to kind of strangle one, which would be kind of a good example for what's happened to us, eventually they're going to spring back. And I feel like that's beginning to happen now. And it's great to see and hear. But specific names, I wouldn't feel comfortable mentioning any just now. But in the near future, I think I'll try to do so.
Okay. Very interesting answer. Thin Red Line says, in German and Scandinavian, here means army, Herr means sir, Herrlich means something like glorious, have more or less the same meaning as is associated with the word Aryan in Sanskrit, which is why I believe that the Germanic people would have said something like Harry-an rather than Aryan. Harry-an. So he's talking about the kind of proto-Germanic pronunciation of the word Aryan.
Yeah.
Interesting. Is it? I don't know if you've got anything to say about that.
Yeah, I don't really have any thoughts on that, but that is interesting. And something I think that I'm vaguely familiar with, and in fact, I'm vaguely familiar with that term itself, because but I can't pinpoint where or why. So it's something I'll poke around more deeply into.
Okay.
It's definitely interesting, though.
All right. Arma Lucas says, Asha, you always seem to have a balanced perspective on Jordan Peterson. Whereas many others abandoned him entirely, you rightly highlighted his positive qualities, despite the shortcomings. That said, how do you view him currently, particularly considering some of his recent associations and statements?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. So I've definitely pulled back on the giving credit while I disparage him, meaning I give less credit and do more disparaging. So when he came back from Russia, I tend to think something happened to him in Russia. He was a different person afterwards. Listening to him speak, I could tell that something was wrong. I have no idea what that something could have been, but he doesn't seem to quite be the same person. Regardless, no matter how far down the current path he goes, I do always try to give credit where due. And the thing about Jordan is I don't think he's a brilliant genius necessarily, but he's obviously not stupid. He was raised with Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, Dostoevsky, brilliant minds all around him that he attempted to read as often as he could. So, I mean, even a stopped clock is right twice a day, and he's far better than a stopped clock. So occasionally he'll shoot out a philosophical insight that will say to me, will prove to me, to my liking anyway, that he has a philosophical handle on the broader picture that most people don't have. So in narrow senses, I can still very much sense his proficiency. But that said, he is somebody that, I mean, obviously, if you followed me on Twitter, you know that I haven't been the most glowing and appreciative fan, to put it mildly. So he seems to have made a conscious decision to work with a subset of people to the detriment of another subset of people. And every indication I get seems to point in this direction. Perhaps he thinks he has his reasons to do so. I don't know what possible justifications a human being could spin for something like that, but that's the impression I get from him. I mean, he recently met with Netanyahu. Virtually the entire intellectual dark web is of a singular background. And he just seems to be so enamored with that culture and that people to a degree that's, I mean, servile and disgusting.
Yes.
And so I can't respect him, broadly speaking, at all anymore. I can still, you know, like I said, occasionally get flashes and senses of, okay, this man was, at least he gravitated towards minds that helped him embrace some good thoughts and good ideas, etc. But he seems to be a broken man. And I'm afraid I directly mentioned that in a tweet, which I almost feel badly for. But the fact that he's just so full of vitriol and anger and hatred, and whether he knows it or not, he's directing a lot of it towards a people that have just been brutalized in recent years and that nobody argues for and nobody stands up for. And it's a disgusting thing to do. And I know that he's done very well for himself recently. I know that he's making a great deal of money. I've heard him brag about that and talk about how that's quite the accomplishment. It's very difficult to make money. But I think that he knows to go down that path, he needs to befriend the right people and the right forces and walk a careful line. And I think he's made a conscious decision to do so. I think almost everybody listening is aware of the Solzhenitsyn question that he was asked on stage, which he refused to answer. And when he refused to answer it, I saw a glimmer of hope, because obviously it hinted that he at least recognized some things behind the scenes. But yeah, that glimmer of hope is gone, as is the glimmer in his eyes, it seems. So he's a broken man, and it's a sad case. And I no longer respect him and consider him an enemy at this point, flat out.
Yeah.
Not a good man.
Yeah, I would actually be more negative towards him than that. I think in a way he's a good example of what we were saying earlier, where attributes of an individual person can be utilized well if that person operates in a healthy culture, or the same attributes can be utilized badly and destructively. Absolutely. If that person is in a sickly culture. And he is in a sickly culture, and he does have abilities. I do believe he's an intelligent guy. I think it's silly when people say he's thick or whatever, he's average. I don't think that. He's clearly highly intelligent. The trouble is that he's in a sickly culture, and so that weaponizes his intelligence against not only his own people, but even against himself. Yeah, so he ends up deluding himself about things in multiple ways. And then on top of that, he's now made apparently, as you say, a positive decision to ally with a group who thrive on lying and thrive on dishonesty and thrive on distortion. And he's now taking part in that very actively, very energetically.
His article on, I think he called it the Jewish question or something to that effect, one of the worst pieces of garbage I've ever read in my life. And it just so clearly showed that he had made a decision, a conscious decision, and that it was almost as if he was signaling this decision to anyone and everyone looking on that Don't worry about me. I'm going to hold the line. Don't take my riches away. Don't destroy me. So that's my assumption that he proactively.
I would agree. I think that while he was a sort of 90s liberal individualist, he was passively unhealthy. Mm-hmm. Now he's made a particular decision to be actively unhealthy. Mm-hmm. And so you've now got him shilling for various things, disparaging various things, disparaging various people. And as you say, this is particularly disgusting because he's attacking
the people who have no active defenders, frankly. I mean, the one segment of society that has absolutely no public defenders at present.
That is that is constantly being attacked. And he tells it not to defend itself, not to even believe in itself, not to see its own existence. That is outrageous.
And they were the people who most gravitated towards him and most relied on him. And the fact that he seems to be slipping the dagger into that back, it's just disgusting.
So he does this to the race that is under attack, but he also does it specifically to the specific section of that race that is under special attack, young white men. This is what all this stuff about Anons, calling them psychopaths, Machiavellians, demons, and all the rest of it. This is a guy who needs social acceptability and respectability so much that he will betray not only his own race, but also the people who have believed in him.
There does seem to be a deep insecurity that he hasn't really tackled or dealt with.
Yes.
He absolutely needs the adulation of the crowd.
And that turns him against, I mean, it propels him away from truth. That's the problem.
Yeah, and maybe on some level he knows that he's stabbed a certain people in the back and he's headed in the wrong direction. Perhaps that's why he seems to burst into tears at a slight breeze lately. I mean, the smallest little, he can read the box of Cheerios and burst into an inconsolable.
It's like there's a sort of
mush.
It's like there's a sort of spiritual sort of Damocles hanging over his head all the time now. And he knows it. It's like, I'm just always on the verge of, I've damned myself. He seems like a man who feels he has
that's a good way to put it. I think that's very apt. He's a damned man, and I think on some level, at least subconsciously, he must have made that connection.
Yeah. But I think he lacks the vocabulary to consciously understand his situation. I think this is all quite...
Or he tries like hell not to. I mean, I think a lot of people like that fight like hell not to recognize certain obvious truths of it. I mean, for him, I know that making money was a very, very significant part of the path that he felt he was supposed to take in life. And you simply can't do that, at least yet. You can't do that while saying certain uncomfortable truths. You will be utterly destroyed. So he had a choice to make, and he made it. And I think he's reaping the consequences at this point.
Yeah, which are psychological consequences. I mean, I think a man like him can't lie without there being a psychological cost.
Yeah.
Because I think at some level he actually is someone who needs the truth and wants the truth and venerates the truth. So I think that to go against it, to be actively dishonest, I think it hurts him. But
I think that's right.
But the need for respectability overrides that, so he's going to do it anyway. He's quite a tragic guy. I mean, you know, you put all those ingredients together, it's a tragic figure.
It's easy to feel sorry for him on some level, but I think the reason why I don't think you and I don't and many others don't is because everything he's doing seems geared towards pushing a certain people towards suicide and extinguishment, essentially. And
it's
an obvious proactive and conscious decision.
Yeah, you're right that I shouldn't feel sorry for him. You see, my empathy is reaching out again. So you're right. I should.
Well, on some level, it's understandable as long as that's overridden by other levels that are more potent and powerful.
Yeah. I mean, he is still a traitor, you know. And the next time I talk about him, I won't be saying, "Oh yeah, you know, I've thought about it again." And he is actually a poor soul. We should feel sorry. No, he is. He is a traitor, and in the worst possible way, because he could have been.
Yeah.
He has the mental abilities, the talents to have been something very different.
That's what pissed me off so much about him, is there's many things that he was saying that I could see myself saying, or things that I felt needed to be said, and things that were causing a very good sort of human being to gravitate towards him. In isolation, he was saying some of these things. And so he did start to draw a good sort of people to an extent. And after he had drawn a sufficient number and a critical mass, that's when he seemed to make the strong left turn. That's also when Russia happened. So who knows if they're connected, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. One of those things we'll probably never know exactly what
that's
happened.
True. But
yeah. One theory I've got, and I wrote this on Telegram about a month ago, is that breaking from the consensus hurt him with the trans issue back in 2016. And it was something that he was driven to do, but immediately it hurt him psychologically because he'd lost the respect of his peers.
He is very, I hate to say it, but he is very weak. You can see this in so many different spheres, but especially if you've ever seen him with his wife and daughter. I mean, it's good to be very loving and very caring and very empathetic, but you can do that while still being a strong man, and he doesn't accomplish that. It's just so obvious that, for example, his wife essentially seems to wear the pants and really call the shots in that household. And I mean, I hate to say this too, but I feel like it needs to be said. I feel like there's such a dark energy with his wife and his daughter, and something very strange going on there. And I think Jordan is actually, you could say he's an incredibly nice person, to put it kindly, to frame it kindly, but he's also, he can be a complete pushover with his family and with everybody. I mean, like I said, I think that he's been pushed into these proactive decisions because he knew he had to take a side, and he was probably approached by a bunch of people who talked about atrocities in the past and how jackboots are coming back if he doesn't stand up against this white nationalism or white identitarianism. And so I think on some level he was able to justify it to himself. And the moment he made that justification, he started to spin a slew of other self-justifications to make himself feel better about it. But at the end of the day, he's a despicable human being and a traitor and an enemy.
Mm. You say he's a very kind man. I don't think he is. Or did he say nice man? I can't remember. But
I would say he's very kind in certain contexts and unkind in others. So I think that's fair. I mean, for example, with his family, I think he is a complete softy and pushover and kind to the extreme degree in many senses. He may have tried to be a disciplinarian in certain other senses, but he's not able to show strength often when it needs to be shown in several different ways. And I think that comes from a root of him trying to be overly kind, but perhaps it comes from somewhere else. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, I just think that he might well be a kind man, but his ambition overrides that.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's leave that. I mean, I think that's a very interesting wee segment there about Jordan Peterson, if I might say so myself.
Yeah. There's a lot to say, and maybe, maybe it should be spoken about in more depth in the future.
Yes. Okay. The next question is from Night Nation Review. Interesting title. Love Asha Logos, one of the best creators we have out here. Hope he would be willing to make an appearance on my own show someday, since we're all such a big fan of his insightful work. Well, there we go. Night Nation Review. It's something for you to bear in mind.
And I should actually use this as a moment to apologize. So I think that, like I said to you when we first began talking, I think that this is the first interview I've done since our last interview. I'm not certain. But so essentially I've done none, and I was planning on keeping it that way. I just didn't want to miss out on one more year of this tradition because I like it so much. But I've said no to just so many interviews and appearances, and I felt terrible about it because I never expected this. I didn't really consider this would be part of my journey. I figured I would just do my work and I could keep my head down and be in complete solitude. But of course, you know, people reach out and they want to work with you, completely understandable. And I'm sure that a lot of people get the impression that I'm aloof or pretentious or whatever. And it makes me, it kind of stings. But I hope people understand that I'm really focused on my type of work right now. and I really appreciate my solitude. That's not to say that I won't do interviews or live streams or anything like that in the future, but they'll be few and far between, I think, at least for a while. I think that when I'm kind of at the end of this subverted history journey, like I said, I'll be pivoting to other things. And but yeah, right now I'm in this mode.
Yes, I understand.
So apologies to anyone offended. Sincere apologies.
One possible solution here would be to do a lot of live streams together at the same time so that it doesn't, so that it's sort of, kind of like what I do actually with Millennial. That's just an idea.
Makes sense.
Okay. There's an insulting super chat from RS. I don't think I'll read that, but thank you anyway. Arma Lucas again says, thoughts on musical decline? It's often a difficult topic, given how deeply people identify with it, but I cannot help but feel something is profoundly wrong when our people are infatuated with mediocre and often degenerate modern music and have little to no appreciation for our greatest composers.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I mean, we don't have the ear, and I would pull back even more broadly. It's as if we've lost the ability to correctly discern and identify certain forms of beauty anymore. And music is a great example of this. I mean, there still is great music, of course. But if you look at a Billboard Top 10 chart, for example, or any of the kind of mainstream music that succeeds, most of it is just not only utter garbage that would be termed garbage because it has no positive value or attributes to it, but it's just actively degenerate and negative in every possible way. So it's almost as if the industry has been weaponized. And if you know the people who largely own and run the industry, perhaps that'll connect some dots, and perhaps it has been weaponized. But I would say, broadly speaking, in every sphere, music being one of them, just everything is being cheapened. And it's as if the energy that made it what it was, and like I said, this applies to almost every artistic sphere and several other spheres, the energy that made it what it was is being sapped and drained. So you still have the simulacrum, you have the kind of stand-in, the straw man, but it's been kind of ripped of all of its guts and its heart, and it's just a placeholder. It's such an empty, hollow, poor excuse for what formerly stood in its place. So yeah, it's incredibly sad to watch. But this is one of the things that will change when everything else begins to change. And it involves creating and fostering and cultivating a new culture that learns to discern and judge based on different criteria and through a different framework and perspective, which is essentially the traditional the framework and perspective nearly all of our ancestors have had for millennia. Up until a very short time ago.
Yeah, I agree that one of the sad things about the censorship and the deplatforming is, I mean, it's bad for the individual content creator, whatever you want to, whatever term you want to use. It's bad for the individual person because it's a bummer. It might mean that you can't make your living from this anymore. You lose your following. It's which in turn means you lose some stature, influence. It also means that you're just not getting the feedback that you were getting. It means you're not reaching the same people. It means you can't reach the general public. So it's bad for all those reasons. It's also bad for the followers because they lose touch with the content that they like and the creators that they admire. But it's also bad, and this is something that's not often said, but it's also bad for culture because it means that we are now... Our culture is now without those ingredients, those elements that naturally spring from the times and should reflect and would reflect those times and would inform the rest of the culture. But that now no longer happens. So meaningful ingredients are now missing from the cultural mix. So the culture is then sort of flailing around and just directionless and hollow and silly. Yeah.
Asymmetrical as well, and just in absolute chaos, because it's as if the guts have been ripped out in a very real way. And like I said, I think it's a purposeful and conscious effort.
Yeah, definitely, because culture should be something that's alive and thriving, but also therapeutic. It should mm-hmm. be a balm for people. It should exactly. be a tonic yeah. for people. It should speak to them. It should be redolent. It should be something that they can identify with and understand and empathize
and
with.
It should provide energy as well. It should be an energy infusion as you embrace this.
Absolutely. Yeah, and people are doing without that. People are doing without that in this age, and I think that's a tragedy, and really a tragedy. I mean, there are people who should be well known, who should be well rewarded, who should get the affirmation, who should be listened to. Their work should be prominent in society, and they're just ignored. And I'm not even talking about myself. I mean, I'm talking about in general. I think this is not just a sort of vain thing. It's when I
absolutely.
Think,
I mean, we all see this all around us if we have open eyes.
I think it's terrible. There could be so many good dramas that are actually pertinent and thought provoking and stimulating and interesting, and people could identify with them. They could speak to people. There should be good films. There should be good music, good literature, good art.
I think people make the mistake. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. That was
people funny. Make the mistake of thinking that. Art and technology take a certain path, and they're kind of locked into that path, especially technology. But they think that there's only that one path. So this is just the natural progression of things, because we have to think in that kind of linear way. But sometimes we fall backwards without knowing it, meaning we're no longer making any forward progress towards any meaningful or fruitful goal. But we are falling back into absolute chaos. Technology doesn't need to progress down the very specific path that we've progressed it down. It's progressing down that specific path because our cultural conditions orient it in that direction. So, for example, people want quick and easy communication. People want fast food. People want movies that don't really challenge them in any way. They're just kind of light fluff. All of these things, all of this artistic and technological development is according to our prevailing culture, which means when you have a different root and seed of a prevailing culture, it will develop a completely different, even technological path, but certainly artistic path. And it could be so much better that I think most people would have a great difficulty even picturing and envisioning what could be.
Absolutely.
But I mean, it's such a vast chasm between what we have and what we could someday have. That if people just were able to glimpse that for a split second, they would never stop fighting every second of their lives to change our present situation.
And I think that's a really interesting point and a really valuable point. I think that people should think about that a lot. You know, if we could glimpse the possibilities, the way that technology could actually complement art, art could reflect human nature. And
technology could complement our natures as well. Yes,
that as well. And all of this could work together in a healthy way instead of this awful, sickly, unhealthy way. I agree. Imagine the pleasure of discussing using real-time digital web technology, discussing with other people a TV show that just happened that was actually brilliant.
Yeah.
Instead of
TV shows could be brilliant. It's so difficult to imagine, but I mean, so many different things could actually be brilliant in a life-affirming type way. And we've just so lost touch with even the possibility of that. It's so difficult to even envision because we're just surrounded by dross everywhere we look.
Yes, I agree. And then one other thing I wanted to pick up on was that we need to create a new culture, and that would in turn lead to these things. I think that's true as well, because simply demanding this stuff, demanding that women care about motherhood, for example, whatever it is, men care about strength, men care about self-sufficiency, resourcefulness. Simply demanding things of the world, unfortunately, doesn't work. I wish it did, and I'm not trying to be condescending here. Because we all do this, we all fall into this. Whereas a culture, it's like a story. A story can get a point across better than an argument can sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, and I think in the same way, people are enchanted, enlivened by a story, they're also nourished and informed by a culture more than they are by prescriptions, and especially negative prescriptions. Like, I'm against this, I'm against that, I'm against X, Y, and Z.
Absolutely. It needs to be a positive vision.
Yes.
All of it needs to be a positive vision. And this is another thing I think that I hope everybody will think about often. We can't have this forcible compulsion, this kind of negative vision in our heads that we're going to dominate and force these people to think as we do. It needs to be a wholly positive vision that people gravitate towards because they resonate with it. And those that don't gravitate toward it, so be it. There will be a separate path that they can take. Everybody should be able to resonate, gravitate toward the flame that they resonate most with, I would say.
Yeah, and on their own heads be it.
Yes. And they would embrace the consequences of that straying.
All right. Missing Link donates $20. Thank you for that very much. And says, got meat. See, this is German. I'm going to mispronounce it. Got meat uns or uns, yes. Which means God with us.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Okay. And Northwind says, Asha Logos, thank you for your work on the Aura Linda. Those videos have been fantastic.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. And then finally, Stephen says, Asha Logos's content isn't really explicit in the way that many of us are, yet there is never any doubt as to his being on side, if you will. Is this a potential path forward for content creators, linguistically evading both the banhammer and also the alarm systems of normies and censors?
It's an insightful person, an insightful question. Yes, I think it is. I mean, obviously, I think it is because that's the path that I've mostly consciously chosen to take. I spoke earlier about red flags existing in the recesses of people's minds. Many people like that, you simply can't penetrate that wall unless you know the perfect route to take. And sometimes that takes some thinking and doing, but it definitely takes not being so overtly explicit and careless with your communication style to where you just trigger every trap that's been laid by subversive forces in their mind to cause them to diminish what you're saying or just reject it wholly or enter attack mode, etc. So yeah, very good question. And I do think I would hope that people would give some strong consideration to that type of path, broadly speaking.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that I kind of regret now, is being explicit, because it has been used against me in more subtle ways, but it's also been used to deplatform me. And I don't know, sometimes I wish I'd just done film reviews and then I would still be able to make a good living from this. that would be nice. I'm sure that I would be making a very good living from that. It'd be delightful. But other times I think, no, it was right to do this. It was truthful. It was honest.
No, I think it was. And I mean, I think both are needed, to be honest. And I have great respect for those people who either refuse to or simply can't. I don't want to say filter themselves, but be more careful. And what's the best way to put it? I'll just put it that way. Be more careful with the way that they, be more guarded maybe with the way that they talk. I don't want to say strategic, that I'm certainly not attempting to deceive or manipulate, but I am attempting to dodge traps that I think were unjustly laid and unfairly laid. And and I think when you can communicate a broader narrative and a broader storyline without having to mention each and every specific that might trip people up along the way, then you've done something valuable. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that a lot of things can be taken for granted. You know, you don't need to explicitly say this or that. People get the idea, especially at this stage in the game. I mean, you know, a lot of groundwork has already been done there. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you do need to say the specific thing, especially when it's when it feels incredibly important and nobody else dares say it. Often that probably a lot of my tweets and gabs probably fall into those categories, to where I just feel absolutely compelled because I know that this would be a net positive to be out there, and that maybe other people aren't saying it because they feel like they can't or they're afraid of the consequences. When I come to a situation like that, I feel absolutely compelled to speak. So sometimes you do need to say the specifics, but broadly speaking, as a man of, as a rule, I think it's more effective to be artful and be careful, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Yeah, I can understand that. Okay, well, I guess we're heading towards a natural end for this conversation. Is there anything that you would like to say to people, perhaps with a mind to leaving them with a positive feeling rather than in the doldrums? I mean, some of what we've said is pretty intense and depressing, yeah. So I don't want to leave them with that. But what would you like to say?
I appreciate you guys immensely, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I honestly feel a love for the people who have said so many kind things that I don't feel like I deserve, and who've sent me so many brilliant letters that I've not responded to, and emails, and so much undeserved love and outreach and communication, that most of which has gone unrequited, to my shame. I genuinely and sincerely, consistently feel a love and warmth for all of you and for what's to come. And I would advise, keep your head up and recognize that it will come, and that these are all just very messy bumps in the road. But we will absolutely get through it. And there is nowhere to go but up. It'll be a fight, but yeah, it doesn't go down from here, and there's nowhere to go but up. And like I said, if we could even glimpse of the chasm that exists between what is and what could be, there would be nonstop determination and energy from every last one of us. So that's pretty much it. And Merry Christmas, if I didn't say that at the end there.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that uplifting message to end with. This has been a fantastic stream. I think one of the best this year. So
thank you. I appreciate it. I liked it a lot. So and I appreciate you having me again. And I very much appreciate that you do this, but I said that several times.
All right. Yes. Yes. Thank you. And I do appreciate those comments. It's very kind of you to say that. Okay. Well, this ends this evening's broadcast. Tomorrow night, I'll be back with UK Column, Toadstool Magazine, Niels Wegner, and Gifts Ungiven. But in the meantime, this has been an eventful evening. I think you would all agree. quite a mix of people. So, Asha Logos, thank you very much.
Thank you. For appearing. Good night. Have a good night, everyone.
All right. Okay. I'll see you all later. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.